Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Good morning. It is Thursday morning, the 21st of June. The sun is rising and that tomb is empty, and that is good news indeed. You know, Logan, I think often of the disciples that when they woke up on that weekend morning, they woke up pretty hopeless at that point. The Savior had been killed. They didn't see any future. And suddenly, as the sun was rising, that tomb was empty. And it didn't change the fact that it was going to be a tough journey ahead for them in this world. But it did mean that whatever's happening in this world does not define all of the future. In fact, the empty tomb is what defines it, and that there's always hope then and always future. So glad to have you back in the studio here.
Happy
you were
to
away
be
for
back.
3 days.
Yes.
Yeah. What did you do on your vacation?
Nothing.
You did nothing. You just sat around and just kind of caught. I understand you caught up in the World Cup a bit.
Caught up is a very loose term for sat on a couch for 12 hours each day and watched every single possible game.
You really did. So you just kind of streamed this through for hour upon hour. But does soccer start looking the same after a while, or can you notice the differences, you know, that are going on?
Well, the jerseys are different colors. That's one option.
That's a very helpful option indeed.
But no, I think it's been an incredible World Cup, just from, you know, being the only two soccer American fans are sitting in this studio right now.
Indeed,
So we're not serving anyone by talking about this at all.
That's very true.
But it's been very exciting.
Oh, I'm so glad. Well, and Paul Perreault is in the newsroom. We're grateful to him and to Rachel Sutton for booking the great guests that are part of this morning show. It's amazing the work that they do to bring on voices from all around our country. Headlines are always so troubling. It's difficult to parent these days. Don't know what to do with social media. Any number of topics that we can get into. And Paul and Rachel do an amazing job each day finding guests that can help talk us through the issues of the day. So I am your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner, and we will get started here in just a moment with a regular guest, Ben Johnson of the Acton Institute, and we'll talk about President Trump's visit to Minnesota, as well as issues on the immigration border and any other things that are happening in the headlines. So stay with us. We'll take a short break and be back with Ben Johnson.
A right given by God, deliver free life.
And that, of course, is the walk-up music of one of our regular guests, Ben Johnson, here on Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner, and Ben joins us each week to talk through a lot of the headlines of the day. He's with the Acton Institute, and they do a lot of work just bringing together ideas of individual liberty and underpin them with religious principles so we can kind of walk out our faith each day in our country and our society. So, Ben, great to have you with us this morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, and greetings from Grand Rapids.
Greetings. You're in Grand Rapids right now.
Yeah, we're having our Acton University, so I'm up here for the week, and it's always good to be here. So, yeah.
Great. Well, before we get started on some of the headlines, I know last week, Ben, you indicated that you really, really did not like soccer. And so I just at least have to ask if in this last week you had any epiphanies, any visitations from Gabriel, any sort of Saul on the road to Damascus moments. Has there been any shift in your life, Ben?
I have remained rock solid steady in my loathing soccer, as have, I believe, the majority of Americans of my age and demographic, yes.
Yeah, I don't begrudge you, but we'll have to check in about that. We just got to see if there's the possibility for change here. So in Minnesota, I'd love for you to just start. We have had President Trump visit us. We have some affiliates in Twin Ports in that neck of the woods where Trump came to the Duluth area. And what's fascinating to me is it seems like the political lines are getting torn up a little bit, where we have a deeply red state in Alabama electing a Democratic senator, and now we have in Minnesota, there's quite a bit of momentum for what has historically been a very blue state, maybe turning red in the upcoming midterms. What are you following some of this, Ben?
You know, I am, and it's not that surprising to me. Really, when people talk about red state America, blue state America, really, they don't mean whole states. And people who live in what's called flyover country have told me this for a very long time. In the state of Michigan, where I am right now, of course, you know, it's very liberal in Detroit, somewhat in Lansing, but Grand Rapids is not. But then when you get into small rural areas, if you remember the county by county map, you know, Donald Trump won, I think it was something like 80% of the counties or something like that. It's major population centers, essentially, that are liberal. I always think of James Carville when he's talking about the state of Pennsylvania, which tends to vote Democratic, but he described it as Philadelphia on the east, Pittsburgh on the west, and Alabama in between.
And that's just it, right? It's just not as simple as saying a state is all red or all blue. There's a lot of just sort of micro demographics that these politicians need to consider when they're running for office.
Yes, and you know, a district like the one in Minnesota is a target of opportunity for Republicans, where there are a great number of conservative votes. And, of course, then I always think of Colin Peterson, who's a Democrat, but votes with Republicans quite a bit as well. That's a seat that Republicans have targeted, but yet, even though it's a Democrat on paper, he's probably the most conservative Democrat in the chamber. So even a putatively and historically Democratic or farm labor constituency, you often have people who tend to vote or at least side somewhat with conservatives, particularly on social issues.
Yeah, it's great. It's going to be fascinating midterms again coming up. Well, let's shift. We'll talk in a minute about just what you're doing this weekend with some of the talks around the alt-right and the alt-left. But we'd be remiss if we didn't at least hit the immigration headlines down at the border for a minute or two. And, of course, yesterday afternoon, President Trump did something that he doesn't often do, which is reverse course, and he signed an executive order to prevent the separation of children from their families. And what went into this reversal? Was it his daughter Ivanka? Was it just the optics of the situation? How did you process what was going on down there?
My thought is that Donald Trump responded to the political pressure here. I think there was tremendous political pressure brought to bear in both parties and with the many in his own administration and his own family. Of course, you saw Melania Trump on the day that all of the first ladies weighed in on the subject. She had previously said that families should stay together in a very public way. So I think that there was tremendous pressure on that front. And simply, I think he genuinely is moved as much as any of us by the optics of this. Even those who would support the need for enforcing the borders would say that in any situation, family unity should be a priority. Families should not be separated any more than is absolutely necessary. And when it comes to this sort of policy, for the most part, those who were separated were either separated by necessity due to the lack of number of facilities, or they were separated because there was some suspicion whether or not they were actually family members. In some cases, smugglers were taking children with them because they had heard that under the Obama administration, there was a catch-and-release policy if you had a child with you. Because of particularly this policy, they did not want to incarcerate children and children and families together. So I think that Donald Trump has moved this momentarily, but as we've seen, executive actions can be taken and then reversed. So ultimately, Congress has to have a solution to this problem. Ted Cruz offered a bill that I thought was just exemplary. It showed absolutely no momentum of passing in the Democratic, picking up any Democratic support and overcoming any kind of filibuster in the Senate. But I think that that's ultimately where we need to look, is for Congress to step forward and to change the underlying law itself, and for DHS and HHS to build capacity so that they can house families together, because right now they don't have enough to handle the number of families that they're getting.
Yeah, at best, it's a temporary solution to the issue. So how long do you foresee that this might take for congressional action moving forward? Is this months? Is this years? What does this look like?
Well, you know, Bob Corker had a great deal of fire to try and pass something within days before the executive order came forward. I hope that that won't stall at all. I think that there's tremendous momentum among Republicans to want to do a fix for this, particularly before the midterm elections. On the other hand, I think that when it comes to Democrats, they want to have this as an issue because they've always hoped to use this, but more particularly the DACA issue, as part of a larger immigration bill that includes amnesty for all illegal immigrants in the United States, in which case you're talking about something like 11 to 13 million, possibly more, according to the numbers that we know. That policy is relatively unpopular, so they need what is sort of a soft sell on the front end, which would be DACA and family unity.
Great stuff, Ben. Your ability to translate the headlines into what's happening, so helpful for me, for our listeners. We appreciate that. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we want to get into your talk that's coming up this weekend, where you're going to help educate some people at Acton around the alt-right and some of identity politics and all of what's there. So we'll be back in just a minute with Ben Johnson of the Acton Institute. It is just about 18 minutes past the hour. This is Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner. And we are joined, as we are each week, by Ben Johnson of the Acton Institute. And Ben, you said you're in Grand Rapids and you're giving a talk this weekend that is focusing on identity politics, the alt-right, Antifa on the left. Just talk us through what you're going to be covering this weekend.
Sure. I'm giving a talk here at Acton University called The Alt-Right, A Christian Perspective. Of course, the alt-right has been in the news so much over the last few years. Hillary Clinton looked at the alt-right, gave a speech, and essentially she said they were the lid of the basket of deplorables. And so that sort of brought them into a public perspective. But then after Donald Trump was elected, we might remember the video of Richard Spencer giving a Nazi-like salute and saying, "Hail Trump." Spencer was sort of unwillingly involved in a national debate over whether it was okay to punch a Nazi when he was punched on live television. And then, of course, the Charlottesville rally over the Confederate monument that ended with Heather Heyer, a 32-year-old Antifa activist, being killed when a man drove a car into a crowd of protesters. So they've been in the news a great deal, but I think there's very little understanding as to who they are and what they believe. And the Hillary Clinton speech was probably exhibit number one. Hillary, when she was talking about the alt-right, named three people, which is Steve Bannon, Nigel Farage, and Vladimir Putin, none of whom I would say are really the alt-right. The alt-right, as I look at it and as they look at it, more importantly, when you look into their publications, basically come down to a very few number of concepts, none of which are shared by those three figures or most people like Breitbart News or other organizations like that, or Donald Trump, Steve Bannon. Essentially, they believe that race is the most important factor in determining who someone is. Again, this is what they believe, and we would find it offensive. Your listeners would find it offensive, but I'm trying to understand them and their thought process, and this is how they see the world, that they are essentially biological determinists. They believe that whatever DNA you happen to have will determine your capacity, both intellectually, but even to a certain extent, morally and in terms of your agency. They believe that there are just biologically determined personality types into which we all fall. And because of that, the world should be separated. They would like to see the United States give place to what they would call the rise of an ethno-state, where every race, as they understand them, would have their own government and would live in their own realm. Now, this may sound like science fiction, but it is something that is picking up a great deal of steam. They're able to pick up in part on the anti-religious pro-science issue out there because they present so much of this as biological science, which is ignored by universities and other places. There's also a great deal of left-wing undercurrent to what they're doing. Millennials yearn for community, true community, and the alt-right speaks of the race as a community. So it gives this false sense that you're part of something larger than yourself and that you have brothers and sisters who love you simply because of who you are and the fact you're a member of that group. But it's essentially poisonous. The best definition that I've heard of what they really look for is Richard Spencer. He summed it up in one line in a radio interview with an alt-right source. He said, "The alt-right is just identity politics for white people. And so they've seen the rise of identity politics on the left among various other organizations and groups, and they wondered, why can't we get in on this? Why can't we have something like this? So they say other races have their own interests, and the white race has its interests as well, and so we need to look out for that.
Well, and I'm curious, when you describe it, it's so helpful of a description, is are we experiencing the momentum of this partially because over the last 30 or 40 years, it's become so easy to travel, technology has brought countries together that historically had sort of their own cultures and races. I think about the European community, and it gets difficult, you know, to try to figure out how to all do life together across racial lines. Is this sort of a bit of a backlash to the difficulty of immigration and bringing people together in sort of this melting pot? Because the world's really gotten a lot closer in the last 30 or 40 years compared to what it was before it was so easy to travel and before technology brought us together.
Yeah, I think that it's a reaction in two ways. The United States has been a magnet for immigration for more than 100 years. And in a sense, it's true that we're a nation of immigrants. On the other hand, it's true that there was a strong assimilationist streak in America. When people came to the United States, they came in order to be part of the United States. And we had a melting pot philosophy that everyone was welcome here. And you heard this on display all the way up and reflected so well in Ronald Reagan's farewell speech, where he said, "This is a great shining city on the hill. It has, if it has to have walls, then they have doors that are open to anyone who is able to get here who believes in freedom." And so those who wish to join the United States and take up our philosophy are welcome to live here in peace and prosperity. On the other hand, for the last 30 or 40 years, we have had essentially a policy of the salad bowl to keep the various elements as separate as possible, to tell people when they come here not to assimilate, even not to learn English to a certain degree. And that, I think, has led to a great deal of dissonance among our populace. Are we really one nation? I think that has fed this. Also, technology has fed the other end of it, which is that this sort of movement would have been impossible 40 or 50 years ago. There have been extremists throughout, and you would have nationally circulated newspapers like the Spotlight or the Thunderbolt back in the old days of the 60s and the Klan and so on. But really, this is the sort of thing that almost requires an internet to put people together around the world because of the ease of communication. Where you would have had one or two isolated extremists who never would have talked to another person and eventually may have grown out of this sort of tendency. Now they can network with others. They have a virtual community that supports them and encourages them and deepens their fervor. So this is tremendously negative, as you can imagine. So and what I'll be looking at is essentially what they believe about race and ethnicity. Religion, many of them, as you can imagine, are intensely anti-Christian. Some of them are outright pagans. Many of them, for example, a French thinker by the name of Alain de Benoist, who's a part of the French Nouveau Droit, the New Right in France, wrote a book called On Being a Pagan. And essentially, the argument that he's used and so many others have is that Christianity drained out the martial spirit of our people. That's why white people don't stand up for themselves, because Christianity teaches, as it truly does, that race and ethnicity are not important. What's important is our faith. Our citizenship is in heaven. We have more in common with believers of other races than we do with non-believers or pagans of our own race or ethnicity. And truly, when it's all said and done, those who are believers in Jesus Christ are brothers and sisters, and there is neither Jew nor Greek, there's neither slave nor free, but there is a new creation. Christ has brought down and destroyed the wall of separation that's divided us, as it says in the book of Ephesians, and he has made one new creation, which is the body of Christ.
Mm, that's great. So Ben Johnson of the Acton Institute. Ben, we just have 1 minute left. A quick question, too, because your descriptions sort of conjure up images of the Ku Klux Klan or possibly the superiority of the Aryan race as understood by Nazi Germany. And so this is difficult stuff to see in our headlines and in our online communities. Do you see a role for online services sort of shutting down the quote-unquote free speech of the alt-right communities, or how do we hold the tension? And again, we just have a minute left before break.
We obviously, they have First Amendment free speech rights, which they are free to exercise. However, Internet communities, as long as we have freedom of commerce in this country, have the right to refuse that business. So I think that this is an argument both for freedom of speech, for them to exercise their freedom of speech wherever they like, but it's also an argument for freedom of commerce, that the internet should remain free, that people should be able to refuse any business that they wish, particularly on the grounds of something as noxious and odious as the views of the alt-right.
Ben Johnson of the Acton Institute, the time goes way too fast. We had way more headlines to cover, so look forward to getting into this again next week. Logan has actually texted you a link to an online soccer streaming service, so the rest of the morning you can get caught up as you're preparing for your talk this morning.
I paid for a full year of subscription,
bless you,
all for you. Yeah.
Yeah, you're all set up, Ben.
Bless you. Goal!
There it is. Let's take a break for Lighten Up, and we'll come back for the news in just a minute.
It's summertime, summertime, some, summertime, 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 summertime.
And so it is the 21st of June, and Paul, over in the newsroom, that means it is the first day of summer, right?
Yeah, that depends on who you ask.
Really? There's a controversy around the first day of summer?
I don't know if there's a controversy, but okay, if you're if you talk to your friendly neighborhood astronomer,
yep.
You ask them, you know, when's the first day of summer? They'll say, well, it starts with the solstice, which would be today. But if you talk to your friendly neighborhood meteorologist, they'll say, no, it starts on, like, June 1st. So, you know.
We just have to argue about everything these days, right?
Yeah,
we just can't
exactly.
Even settle together on even at the beginning of summer. Let's head to news here. And when we come back for the second half, we will be talking with Matthew Sorens from World Relief about issues down at the border.
Oh, I love to take a trip. I'm sorry.
Psychologist and author Dr. David Walsh gives us some insight into the mind of the teenagers, and he's talking specifically about the difference biologically between girls' and boys' brains this morning.
A girl's brain is designed by God to have some brain-based advantage when it comes to language. The language areas of the brain, for example, are more densely packed with brain cells in girls' brains than boys' brains, which might explain why girls, on average, tend to talk before little boys do, why boys are much more likely to have stuttering or reading problems than girls. And even at the other end of the lifespan, if a man and a woman both suffer a stroke later in life, and that stroke affects their language areas, a woman is much more likely to regain language than a man. So there are lots of behavioral indications that the female brain has some brain-based advantage for language. Now, that turns up in school. That turns up in the way kids navigate adolescence. So girls are much more likely to talk about what's going on inside. Boys are a little bit more likely to kind of keep the door shut. So a lot of those brain-based differences show up in the behavior.
That is Dr. David Walsh. If you want to catch the entirety of his teaching, you can go to myfaithradio.com and search for Dr. David Walsh or The Mind of the Teenager and catch the entire thing. We'll be back in a minute with Matthew Sorens from World Relief to talk about some firsthand experiences down at the border. Stay with us.
What would you say is the most important issue in our culture today? This is Jim Garlow. I propose that the answer is values in our society, good values, and good people defending them. Listen to this description of King Hezekiah in 2 Chronicles 31:20. This is what Hezekiah did throughout Judah, doing what was good and right and faithful before the Lord his God. In everything that he undertook in the service of God's temple and in obedience to the law and the commands, he sought his God and worked wholeheartedly. Whoa. It's possible that you can have bad people that actually defend good values, but it doesn't happen all that often. It's a lot more likely you'll have bad people defending bad values. So what's the solution? Godly homes that produce godly, stable people with biblical understanding of godly values. Get the details at jimgarlow.com and be prepared to live out your faith.
It is 22 minutes before the top of the hour. This is Faith Radio Mornings, and I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner. And we are joined at this time on the line by Matthew Sorens, who is the U.S. Director of Church Mobilization for World Relief. And Matthew has been recently spending some time with some firsthand experience down at the border where all of this immigration conversation is happening and the difficult images and all of trying to sort it out. He is actually in El Paso, Texas this morning. So, Matt, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So what have you seen? Just tell our listeners a bit about what you've been up to. And you did a Facebook Live stream yesterday. What are you noticing? What are your observations that may help us get through the sound bites of the news and really understand what's happening down there?
Yeah, you know, a few days ago, we decided at World Relief that, you know, we've been very concerned about this new zero tolerance policy that's having the effect of, has had the effect of separating kids from their parents. And we've been raising a lot of awareness about it. We decided we should just go down and see what we can see. One of the facilities, this has happened at different points along the border, but one of the facilities to actually hold and process children after they've been taken from their parents, and also it's also children who are apprehended unaccompanied, is in Tornillo, Texas. It's about 45 minutes from El Paso. So we were there yesterday, you know, we couldn't go into the facility. It's for good reasons. They don't want just anyone walking in, and they need to protect the kids. But we wanted to see, you know, understand what we could, what was happening. There's actually been, you know, a number of protests and that sort of thing as well. So we saw some that sort of thing at one point. But mostly, we wanted to raise awareness about what was happening and really encourage the church to continue speaking up. We've been really amazed at the advocacy of people saying we really don't want to see kids separated from their parents.
Did you get a chance to see what the conditions are actually like for the kids and for the families? Are they real difficult conditions? Just give us a sense of what it's like when they're separated, where they're living, and how hard that might be.
Yeah, we weren't allowed to go in ourselves, but we have actually I was talking to a journalist yesterday who was able to go in on a kind of a planned tour. You know, I think that it's not that they're trying to harm anyone, but it's just it's a very large facility for a lot of people. And the most, you know, really horrific thing in my mind is it's children, sometimes small children, who have just been taken away from their parents and who don't know where their parents are. And the parents often don't know where the children are. And they could be separated in some cases for weeks or even months. I mean, so it's not that the conditions are necessarily, you know, I think the conditions themselves are probably less important than the relational dynamic of the trauma that's being done to children when they are taken away from their parents. And that's, you know, I'm a father. That's the part that I am so deeply troubled by.
Yeah. And, you know, it's one of those things too, where the kids, regardless of whether they're being used to start, you know, smuggle other things in, or if it's a legitimate immigration situation, the kids don't know what's happening. And all they know is they're being separated from their parents at this moment. And so it is traumatic. I would imagine what you see. Is there quite a bit of tension down there at the border as well?
Yeah, I think that people are, you know, here and just as it is in the rest of the country, but it's so close here and so almost tangible in the air that people are really troubled by what's happening. So, and I should say, there's even as people are going live on Facebook yesterday, there was potential changes. We're still waiting to see what's going to come from this. But the president did sign an executive order yesterday. There are a lot of questions, so I think it's a positive step to be sure, because you know the order is to stop separating children. It's still worth noting that there are still children in that facility. They haven't been reunited with their parents, and there isn't. Hasn't been any announcement of a plan for that to happen. And it's also, it's a positive step, but with some negative dynamics as well, because at least according to the order, what they're going to attempt to do is instead of separating families, they're going to detain families together, which is probably marginally better than being separated for sure. But our general view at World Relief is that actually we don't think that kids belong in jail-like detention facilities, even with their parents. And we think there's better ways where we can make sure that people show up when they have an immigration court, but not have to keep kids in facilities for long periods of time.
Yeah, my understanding is there's nothing about the executive order that changed the situation for the 2,300 children who have been separated already. They need to sort that out. Say, Logan and studio here has a question for you as well about what you're seeing.
Yeah, Matthew, I mean, we've definitely seen sort of a struggle. You mentioned the journalist who had a planned tour through, and originally these facilities were releasing pictures they had taken themselves. What kind of resistance are you seeing in terms of just being able to get a look at what's happening? Are you sort of getting a lot of red tape, or are you allowed some sort of freedom?
I mean, we can get a certain distance up to the facility, just, you know, from outside on public property, but that's basically it. But, you know, we've been able to talk to a lot of people, and actually we were able to go over to Juarez, to the Mexican side of the border yesterday as well, which was interesting. I missed out on this because I had a flight delay, but some of my colleagues were over there yesterday morning on the Mexican side, where there's been a number of people. In this case, it was a Guatemalan woman who and her children who have been trying to go to the port of entry there at the bridge to request asylum, which is completely legal under U.S. law, and had been turned away several times and told, sorry, we don't have capacity, and then sent back. But eventually, actually, in this case, in part, I think because there was a bunch of reporters there, after about an hour, she was able to come. This is several days she's been trying this, but when they kind of set it up with a bunch of reporters there, she was able to request asylum. Now, whether she'll be granted it or not is still, of course, that'll be months away, but she was allowed in to be processed and to begin the process of really testing if she has a credible fear of persecution, which is what the definition of asylum is someone who has a credible fear of persecution for particular reasons.
It's Matthew Sorens from World Relief. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, Matthew, I would love to ask you more about both the role of the government in this, but where you're really about is what the role of the church is and how we as believers can help. So let's take a short break, and we'll be back with more. It is 13 minutes before the top of the hour. This is Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner, and we are joined on the line right now by Matthew Sorens of World Relief, and he is down in El Paso, Texas, and he's got some eyes and ears on the situation down at the border. And before the break, Matthew, we were talking about that the government has a role in trying to sort out the situation, and the church also can have a role. Starting with government, my understanding is one of the bills offered by one of the senators of Texas, Ted Cruz, is that they want to double or more the number of judges down there from 300 to 700 to try to help expedite the vetting process. Have you seen some of that down in where you are right now?
Yeah, I mean, that's not necessarily happening yet, but that's one of the proposals. And I do think it's actually, that is one of the challenges with this, is we want people to have due process. I hope all people would agree that that's, you know, our laws should be followed fairly to make sure that people who are vulnerable, who qualify under the law for asylum, are able to apply for it. But one of the challenges is that can take a very long time because there's such a backlog. And the real question is, what do you do with people while they're waiting? And the new policy has sort of been, well, let's basically detain them, whether with or without their children. Now it looks like it'll be with in most cases. But I think it would be wise to have a more efficient process, but also respecting due process. We want people to have time to find a lawyer and to build their case for asylum as well. So, I think we're watching that carefully in some of the legislative proposals on this. And one of the things that we've been saying at World Relief is at the root of this challenge that separated kids from families is actually the zero tolerance policy. And we think that's actually been a mistake. We would think it would be much better to go back to the way it was under the Bush administration, under the Obama administration, even under the first part of the Trump administration, where federal law enforcement used discretion. So if someone was coming with children or was coming to seek asylum under the law, just the same way that a police officer can use discretion when, you know, you're speeding, but it turns out you're speeding to get to the emergency room with a medical emergency in the back seat. You could take discretion, consider the circumstances, and yes, put someone into an immigration proceeding to determine if they really do meet the standards for asylum, but not have to charge them criminally, which is what reportedly they're trying to do in all cases now. And that does not seem to be affected in any way by the executive order yesterday.
Yeah, and it's so important to get expedite the process, because while there is some abuses happening down at the border, clearly, and we need to have a border security, there's also families that are simply fleeing for their lives and trying to just get through to some measure of safety and just to get through this process much more quickly would be helpful. You know, Matthew, I think one of the things that maybe people in the church and believers maybe all around the country are troubled by is the headlines, but not really knowing what they could possibly do about it, feeling disempowered, maybe angry. Can you help just our daily situation as believers? What can we do to maybe enter into the process a bit more?
Yeah, you know, one thing that we have decided to do at World Relief, we've been trying to figure out, well, what could we do? We're not really located here at the border, but we have looked for is our ways we can, you know, help people get in to minister to these kids. And frankly, we haven't been able to find that ways in. It's a secure facility. And I'm not aware of any churches that have really been able to access them. But there are asylum seekers who after a certain amount of time have been released in some cases. And we may see that more with this change in the executive order, depending on how some of the courts rule on it. There are organizations here in El Paso. There's a great organization called Ciudad Nueva, so a new city in Spanish, but Ciudad Nueva, run by a former colleague of mine who's at an Anglican church. So they're doing really great work. We've also been able at World Relief to say, you know, we have legal services around the country that do immigration legal services. So we're actually sending some of our immigration attorneys down here to the area because we've been told that they may be able to be helpful in helping people sort through their cases. You know, we only have a few folks we can send, but we're going to do that, and people have been able to help raise some funds for that as part of our World Refugee Day campaign at my.worldrelief.org. So we'd really love any help with that to get some of our folks down here to help as much as they can.
Yeah, and give us that again. I wanted to get into that. It actually is, interestingly enough, it was yesterday, it was World Refugee Day. And so give us your website again and a little bit about where people can go to help on that side of things.
Sure. The website overall is worldrelief.org, but at my.worldrelief.org, we have a special campaign up for World Refugee Day that we've been doing for, you know, we've planned this for months because yesterday is every year, June 20th, it's World Refugee Day. But we really think that this fits into the idea of the global refugee crisis. These are people who are fleeing usually gang violence in El Salvador or Honduras or Guatemala. And, you know, they're claiming to meet the definition of a refugee with a well-founded fear of persecution. Of course, the government's role is to determine that. But we also want to make sure that they're well represented. So that's why we're sending some of our immigration attorneys from World Relief down here to help wherever they can. We're still determining, you know, they may or may not be able to access children or maybe with the parents. We're going to have to figure that out. But we want to make them available. And so people can help raise funds for that, even just cover transportation costs, things like that at my.worldrelief.org, and that can also help the larger work that we do around the U.S. of welcoming refugees into the country, which we think is really urgent as well.
Matthew, I wonder if it's possible to give the idea of a toy donation for these kids who are obviously struggling with the separation of their parents, and maybe we don't have access to the facility, but if we were to deliver a box of toys to these kids who clearly need some comfort in their lives, is that something you could see as beneficial or possible through this red tape?
You know, I can certainly see how it might be, beneficial. I don't think it's probably possible from what I've been able to ascertain. The kids are, you know, for the most part, being kept quite isolated from any sort of public inquiry. And that could be frustrating because I know there's people who just want to help. I think also there is the dynamic of obviously they want to keep anyone who would do harm to children away from them. But that's, I think, you know, there is a lot of bureaucracy involved and a lot of high level of distance that's kept from anyone, whether well-meaning or not, and these kids who are in these facilities. It is worth noting, too, like the facility here, it's temporary processing, so eventually they'll go to some sort of a shelter if there's space, and this is one of the challenges, is when you're taking kids from their parents, the system for kids who showed up unaccompanied was one thing, but now there's been more. And then they're usually released to foster families. And so they, for example, there's groups like Bethany Christian Services that work with the Department of Health and Human Services to provide foster families. Now, they've been really clear at Bethany, these kids should be with their parents. They shouldn't, you know, they're going to find the best foster family they can, but they really should be with their parents because it's never ideal to be taken away from your parents. And, I mean, they're dealing with small children who are just emotionally devastated and unfortunately probably traumatized on a fairly long term. But that's one thing people could, you know, that's a high level of commitment. It's a lot more than sending a toy. But if there are people who want to be foster families, there are kids who have been through a lot and hopefully will eventually be reunited with their parents. But even that is, it's a real question how that process is going to work, because it doesn't seem particularly that there's a clear plan for what that will look like.
Speaking with Matthew Sorens from World Relief, Matthew, thank you for joining us this morning. Give us a little sense of what's happening down at the border. And again, for our listeners, just one way to participate that might help break the logjam feeling disempowered is to go to worldrelief.org. And there's a lot of resources you can access to help participate in what's going on. We'll take a short break and we'll wrap up our hour. It is 3 minutes before the top of the hour. This is Faith Radio Mornings, and I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner. And Logan, I love the note that you sent me just during the conversation there, where we do feel, I think, so often disempowered by what we can do down at the border, and there's all this red tape, and can we get through to help and see these kids? And you sent me the note that bureaucracy can't keep out prayer.
There's absolutely no doubt that there's so much that we find difficult to do in this world. Obviously, this is one situation where it feels like we as a church can't do anything physically, but no amount of red tape can keep out prayer and wanting something to happen in this world that only God is capable of. Making those words known to the Lord and just lifting that up is something that can clear this logjam better than anything I can imagine.
Yeah, prayer is fascinating to me. I mean, when you read through the biblical text, when people pray, things actually do happen. And I don't understand how this whole thing works. I absolutely believe it. But I'm amazed at how perceptions shift and hearts soften and minds change. And it is something that if we all joined together as a church and prayed, I think things might matter.
And right now is that time that that's really all that can happen. You know, we all know this is a difficult situation. It's just a matter of fixing it and fixing it as quickly as we can. So that's going to take some heart, maybe some heart softening, some people coming across the aisle and just figuring out what we can do to fix it.
And what a great opportunity and such a fractured environment so often for the church to demonstrate a sense of unity across denominational boundaries, to come together on the singular issue and really pray and ask for God's kingdom to come in these situations. So we're at the top of our hour. We'll take a break for news. And when we come back, we'll be joined by Joel Hansen of Pray for Rain.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.